I was going to give a talk that touches on a few different topics, but in generally, I'll start with a few general trends and then give some examples specific in the health domain in the last part of the talk. So if you look at the thinking about innovation in general, particularly in the high GDP countries, just talking very generally, over the years, over the past couple hundred years, we've become very good at building things. We become, you know, things from the Industrial Revolution, then CAD-CAM, and now we even have desktop manufacturing where you can have 3D printers. We can prototype things very quickly. We also have great tools for building things. Obviously, we can build things very large, ranging from skyscrapers to the pyramids, and all the way down to very tiny. We can now manipulate single atoms. And equally in transportation, there's been obviously a lot of revolutions from, you know, hot air balloons to trains, planes, and putting people on the moon. And you can talk about this in other domains too, such as agriculture, the way that agriculture has been revolutionized and become industrialized with high machinery, and also materials revolutions that's really catalyzed a lot of the products we have today, such as composites and plastics. But then, of course, you know, there's other systems like weapons and electronics and consumer products that we know today. But I also wanted to point out, and in this talk, think about a little bit of the innovation that comes from poorer countries and poorer regions and why that is. And one example that I like to give, which has been an inspiration for my work, is a person named J.C. Bose, who lived at the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, in Calcutta, India. And he was a pioneer in radio waves. So he was a peer of Marconi, a contemporary of Marconi, but he actually was one of the first people to transmit and receive radio waves. So Marconi became famous for transmitting information. Bose wasn't sending data, he was just looking at the signal, but he did some of the pioneering work in radio receivers that Marconi used, and also he invented a lot of microwave devices such as the microwave horn, the polarizer, and things that we do today. And if you study his life, you'll find that he was an extremely creative person, and he built a lot of his very ingenious machinery using materials from around the house and things he found in his backyard. So he's just an amazingly creative person. And he also dedicated the second half of his life to studying living plants. So after he became famous doing all his work with radio waves and being recognized by the Royal Society of London, he started studying plants and built a lot of ingenious machinery to study the life of plants. So why is it that innovation comes from developing countries? Well, some of it comes from basic human needs. There's a need to create and find cheap fuels. So, for example, the cow dung has been used as fuel just out of necessity in some places. People need to have basic food, and milk is a basic nutrient, and there's a need for sanitation. But sometimes innovation comes from other economic or social needs, such as, let's say you're a farmer and you want to know the prices of a certain commodity, or you want to know the news, or maybe even something as simple as you want to know the cricket scores from your favorite team. So in places, there are still some places around the world, such as Monrovia, that have these automated chalkboards where the news and messages are put on a chalkboard, and you can actually send this guy a text message, you know, what you want to post to that chalkboard, and he'll put it up. So there's this interesting hybrid of sort of the high-tech and low-tech. Sometimes another need is energy. So in some places, it's very difficult to find reliable electricity. So you have things that are either battery-powered, like phones, but you also have the invention of the wind-up radio that was created about 15 years ago. And you have technologies such as e-ink that require very low power. And this phone here is a model that was produced by Motorola that uses e-ink for the display. Sometimes it's some of these technologies arise out of conflict or disease. And so, for example, the wind up radio, I had the pleasure of having lunch with the inventor, Trevor Bayliss from South Africa. And he actually told me that one of the original reasons he invented the radio was the wind up radio is because at that time there was a lot of conflict happening in Africa, and still is, but people wanted to have news of what was going on, and they had no means of receiving news. So people who had a radio were able to get early warnings about things that are happening. So let's say like a gang is, or some military people are advancing onto your village. You'd like to know ahead of time so you could evacuate and move somewhere else. And there's also an AIDS epidemic and an AIDS crisis in South Africa region at the time as well. Another example is Chernobyl in 1987, in the Soviet Union. And back at that time, the government created these low-cost radiation detectors, radiation monitors, that people can buy at a very low price. I don't know if they were actually given to people or if people had to buy them, but they were very low cost, and they were produced in high volume. And I actually bought one. I think I have one here myself. I could show you if anyone's interested, that I bought in Berlin in 1989. But this allowed people to be able to monitor their own environment and go places they could check to see if it was safe to go somewhere. And of course, now with the Fukushima disaster in Japan, there's a similar interest in having technologies such as this, where you have low-cost radiation monitoring. Another sort of topic I'd like to point out, and this is somewhat obvious, but I'll just touch on a few points here, is that the world is changing. You know, it's always changing, but there's an interesting change happening right now between the developed world and the developing world. And you can see this in terms of population, that a lot of the population growth is actually coming from the developing world rather than the developed world. And also the energy needs and energy demands are also increasing from other parts of the world that not necessarily the most developed countries. If you look at data needs or data requirements, you can see that cell phones are now comprising the majority of people's IT infrastructure. And another thing I'd like to point out here is that broadband mobile is really what's taking over most of the world. So you're starting to see it here in the U.S., but it's already been happening for many years in developing countries, where most people don't have a PC, most people don't have a computer. The only place they've ever seen the internet is on a phone. So the phone is really becoming the place to interact with the internet and all the other services that live on the internet. The mobile phone subscriptions, 10 years ago, most of the mobile phone subscribers lived in the developed world, and now 3/4 of the world's mobile phone subscribers live in developing countries. So the demographic is changing. And something I usually point out is that there's also a side effect to this, which is environmental impact, which I think I'll touch on this a little bit later. But obviously, all this proliferation of phones and small technologies, and also people's need, and you know, you want to have a new phone every year, every couple of years. You know, the old phones and the old technologies have to go somewhere. So I think there's an interesting opportunity to make use of old or recycled equipment. So some of the new trends that have been arising as a result is downsizing. So obviously, in the late 20th century, the SUVs became sort of an icon of Western living, and still, if you go around the world today, like the people who are wealthy in a developing country, they're like, okay, I'm going to have a lot of money and I'm going to buy an SUV. So, but increasingly, there's more interest in downsizing, going to smaller cars and smaller vehicles that are also more affordable. The same thing with computers. So, obviously, something like the netbook was actually pretty controversial 10 years ago. And at MIT, Nicholas Negroponte started the concept of one laptop per child and making these low-cost laptops. And you know you can argue how successful that program has been, but one thing that's been a side effect, which has been very important influence, is that it sort of started this trend of netbooks and having that, recognizing that you don't always need a very super powerful computer, that sometimes having a simple computer that has internet access is good enough for a lot of things. And obviously now, you know, everything's moving to the phone to access those services. The other thing which hasn't yet fully matured in the US, but is starting to sprout up all over the developing world, is mobile finance. So a surprising amount of people around the world don't have a bank account. Even in places that you might think are fairly well developed, like Latin America. So you think of Latin America as, you know, pretty well developed, but yet a surprising fraction, like almost half of the people, don't have a bank account. So a lot of the transactions either happen through cash, and there's been, for various reasons, in Kenya, you know, either because there was a safety concerns for carrying large sums of money in your pocket or other reasons, there was developed the M-Pesa payment system. So you can pay essentially through your phone by texting, sending a text message with codes. So you know, it's sort of like a cross between PayPal and Twitter. So you can pay for stuff with over your phone just through a little SMS text message. And something that's, you know, a curious example is that there are actually places in Kenya where you can go up to a vending machine and you can get like water or certain things from the vending machine just using your M-Pesa account. So it's actually all over. And companies in the US, including, you know, large companies like PayPal and Google and even like Nokia and Microsoft, everyone's sort of struggling to find out what is the mobile payment solution that's going to become a standard here in the US. And it's still, you know, an open question. But Kenya, M-Pesa in Kenya already has over 200 million users, so they're by far the most successful. And obviously, you know, the other huge trend that we've seen the past, even just the past 5 years, is the emergence of social networks and things like Facebook, and all the ability that and power that these networks have to do like political activism and to bring people together in a very short time. So we've seen the Arab Spring last year, and there's many examples. You know, the Occupy movement, for example, here in the U.S. I just want to mention a couple other trends that have arisen because of technology that we're also trying to change. And you know, a very simple one is if you look at just looking at efficiency. So you look at something like Microsoft Word, and I made this graph when I was a grad student, and back then I was just in the late 90s was a sort of time when almost every year you'd see a new release from Microsoft, and then the little box of floppy disks kept getting bigger and bigger, and suddenly you had like 20 floppy disks, you know, to install your Word. And I was thinking, oh gosh, what's going on? And because I didn't really see Word improving that much, so like the number of useful features were still about the same. And even now, I have Office 2010 on my computer here, and it's the same features. It's just like the menu got rearranged into these little tabs. But anyway, like I realize you have to, you know, there are business reasons for sort of like repackaging what you have. But the point is that there's a lot of waste. Something else that we learned in engineering in the area of waste and efficiency is that obviously when you have a large system, it's very useful in design to break up your system into components and to modules. And certainly for people who do software, it's very important to define the proper API or interface between one module and another module. So modular design is very scalable, and it's a great paradigm. However, for building very small or very integrated things when they really have to use a minimum resources, you really, there are situations where you have to break the rules. And if you really want to fit some code into a very tiny memory size, or if you want to build, if you just look at the electronics of toys, so you might find some toys where, or even automotive industry is another example, where you look at the circuit and the same transistor might be doing two or three different functions. So it's integrated, and obviously it makes it more difficult to debug, but it saves resources and it's much lower cost. There's other examples of places where, if you look at in terms of a system, there's besides electronics and technology, there's energy, water, waste, payment, and securities. These are all examples of different systems that can either be centralized or decentralized. So what's the cost of that? So one example, and this is a slide from the Department of Energy, here are the sources of energy on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side is the consumption of energy. So where's the energy going? So on the left you see solar, nuclear, wind, et cetera, and on the right side you see what portion goes to vehicles, what portion are industrial, what portion goes to residential, homes or office buildings. But one thing that's very interesting here is if you look at this gray bar, you can see that over half of the energy is lost in just transporting the energy from one place to another. So there's an example of the sort of losses you get when there are centralized systems. So one of the topics that we're thinking about at MIT, as well as I'm sure many other labs around the world, is looking at sustainability and how you can create infrastructure that's a little bit more local. So for example, does it make sense for communities to generate their own power? And even thinking about other things, how about food? Can communities grow their own food? Can you take care of your own sanitation, et cetera? And the same story that I have here about energy can be said for other things. So food, I've heard some statistics about food that a large fraction of food is lost or wasted just in the transportation. So, that's the main idea. Can we think about more decentralized systems? I'm just going to just quickly now go through a few examples of projects that we've done. So some of the technologies that I've worked on are things related to sensors, because that's sort of my expertise. In the late 90s, we've had various workshops with children to have children be able to post their own local weather data on a website. And the idea here was so children can learn about other cultures, and knowing that the weather is different in different parts of the world, and use that as sort of a way to break the ice, if you will, to start conversations going. So I had a little workshop where I had the kids build their own little weather probe or weather station that they can use. At that time, it was with a dial-up connection to get. Then we've done, over the years, a variety of different websites and networks, not only for children, but also for bringing seniors together. There's been larger initiatives for children around the world. I've also been looking at expanding environmental sensing to include phones, and looking at integrating that into websites so you can have sensor maps. And obviously, things like the Google Map API have been very powerful and used by thousands of projects in a very useful way for environmental sensing and other things. I'll skip over. Well, one thing regarding connectivity, development is a moving target. So if you go to a village that has, let's say maybe today they might have nothing in terms of connectivity or power, But you come back 2 years later, it'll be a very different place. So we were thinking, you know, how can we sort of kickstart connectivity and have a migration path? Because it's always a chicken and egg. And the problem was that large companies like, let's say, Motorola, they don't want to put up a cell phone tower in a place where they can't get any people to pay for it. So how do you get started? How do you go from like no connectivity to full broadband? So 10 years ago, we created this system, which was a little bit controversial at the time, but this is just when Wi-Fi was starting in the late 90s. So I helped create this store and forward system where you have Wi-Fi clients for use for a variety of different things, you know, in a standard way, but the way the data gets pushed is not real time. We put Wi-Fi access points on vehicles, and as the vehicles go around through the village, it picks up and delivers the data. And obviously, you know, this is not your long-term solution, but it's a way to get started at a very low cost. And the other key thing is that it keeps the interface the same. So people can still be using standard computers with Wi-Fi, and we, at MIT, the computer science department built a web browser that used, on the back end, they use SMTP, so you can do Google searches, but it would package up, when you do a search, it packages up your query into an email, which then gets picked up, it goes, you know, to the satellite, goes back to the US, and then comes back, and then next time the vehicle comes around, you get back your results. So that's, you know, I mean, it's better than nothing, right? So this is an example, here's a picture of some folks in Cambodia. These were the motorcycle drivers. Each one of them has an access point on the back of their motorcycle. And they work full time. Their job was to drive about 6 to 8 hours every day on a route and you know, pick up and deliver data. So, and this worked for, this was an operation for about 6 years. And we connected up to 85 schools in Cambodia this way. And this was a picture of our first school that we connected. And this all ran off of a solar panel. And we had a Linux box that we provided that was a Wi-Fi client. And also, this was a cache where, because these devices, the more power-hungry devices would not be on all the time, but the Linux box could be on 24/7. So this way, when the motorcycle comes by, the computer, you guarantee that the computer's not going to be turned off. So. And then, I have a video, but I'll skip the video in the interest of time. So in general, we're looking at trends in technology, ways to, instead of looking at faster, smaller, and higher power, we're looking at other design paradigm where you can make things that are human size, human speed, less power, fewer parts, and in general, more sustainable and more maintainable. Something I'll mention about human size is that if things are too small, it really shuts off the opportunity to learn from them. So, like, for example, I learned about radios and electronics by taking things apart when I was growing up. So I've taken apart several car engines, and I used to take apart radios and toasters when I was a kid. At that time, you can actually take something apart and see how it worked, but you can't do that to the same extent today because everything is so integrated. It's just like a chip, and there's not much you can do unless you have, you know, really good debugging tools. One concept that we did just as a kind of an exercise was could we design a printer that uses no consumables? So we took this on, or I took this on as a design challenge because a printer is often viewed as a sort of a poster child or for waste, and you know, printers use electricity, paper, and ink. So can you make something that can print? And my original idea was just to use a sunlight and have a little, like a stencil wheel that's programmable that moves over a piece of paper, and then you burn the letters into the paper. And you can even make your own paper if you want it to go crazy. So we actually built something, but instead of using standard paper, I'll see if this boots up. But instead of using standard paper, one of our sponsors makes a special photochromic paper that actually changes color when exposed to light. And that ended up being a very nice material to work with. And I don't actually see a sound, an audio. Let me move my microphone to it.
Challenge conventional assumptions about printing and to explore simple engineering design. We set out to create a printing machine that uses only renewable energy and no consumables. Such a printer could be outfitted with a low-power wireless link that can receive data from a nearby PC and also perhaps from a local broadcast radio station. In its simplest incarnation, the EcoPrinter is a programmable stencil wheel which shapes the light projected on a printing surface. Rather than pulling the paper through the machine, we were interested in creating a machine which moves over the paper. This allows for printing on a variety of materials comprising a wide range of sizes and thicknesses. Instead of ink, the EcoPrinter makes use of photochromic materials, which change color when exposed to certain wavelengths of light. While conventional photochromic inks have been used for decades to create color-changing fabrics and novelty items, these materials are simply activated by ultraviolet light, but slowly fade when brought indoors. More recently, however, new reversible forms of organic photochromic compounds have been created, which have greater stability and can be both printed and erased using different colors of light. To illustrate the use of these new materials, here we show how a focused sunlight beam can be used to selectively erase a sheet of photochromic paper that had been previously activated by ultraviolet light. Using this method, it is possible to generate white letters on a magenta background. The current EcoPrinter design consists of three small motors, two for the body and one for the stencil. By using low-power DC motors instead of servo motors for the body, we were able to create a design that is very low cost and consumes only 0.4 watts of power, which is less than most cell phones. Using a rechargeable battery and a solar-powered charger, the EcoPrinter can run for over 40 hours on a single charge. While the outdoor use of the EcoPrinter requires proper alignment of the sunlight and lens, a more practical configuration makes use of an alternate light source in the form of a low-power ultraviolet LED. By starting with the paper in its blank state, the LED is used to print magenta letters on the white background. The printing time and contrast can be adjusted by varying the brightness of the LED, depending on the desired power consumption. Our current design has been set to a very slow printing speed in order to minimize the power consumption. Here we see the EcoPrinter printing the word design. And finally, we demonstrate how the printed letters can be erased using a green flashlight to reset the paper back to its blank state. We hope that our simple EcoPrinter demonstration will help to stimulate the...
I'll stop there. So that's a simple example of kind of a mix of old and new technology, and it shows how some very old things like a daisy wheel printer with a stencil can be combined with high-tech material science and chemistry to create something that's sustainable and actually, you know, interesting. And as a design project, we thought about how we can do graphics. And I don't know if people remember the old ASCII 2 graphics from the late 70s and early 80s, but there's a lot of interesting creativity that people have done to be able to do things even just with fixed characters. Okay, now I'm just going to quickly, in this last part of my talk, I'm just going to quickly show you a couple examples from the health area, which is where I predominantly work right now. I build sensors for global health and also environmental monitoring. So one of the standard ways of using technology for health, which you may be aware of, is you may wear a sensor on your body, like a chest strap, and you might go running, and you can send that data to your phone, and then now there are various services like RunKeeper, for example, where you can send data up to a cloud. And there's also other examples, such as baby monitors, that do similar things. There are also systems that go in the other direction, where you have some sort of service or program in the cloud or on the server side that then sends data to your phone. And most of the ones that are on the market these days are very simple, and they're just simply things like medication reminders. You know, did you remember to take your pill? Did you remember to exercise today? And there are some explorations into mental health and things like addictions, where the messages that you receive could be messages that also help you think, or could be part of some therapy or a program that you're on. So what I've been working on is a design that combines both of these. So you have bidirectional. So the sensors send data to the phone and up to the cloud, and that detects something, and then you get a response back that's based on the data. And so in this way, you can build sort of this feedback loop. And just an example, which I won't discuss in detail here, but I'll just mention it kind of in passing, is drug addiction. So I just finished working on an NIH grant where we were working with a system like this for people who are addicted to cocaine. And the idea was that we program the phones and the sensor bands to be able to detect when you're feeling nervous or anxious and aroused. And then when the phone detects that you're feeling anxious, it will send you a message that psychologically reminds you that you should not take cocaine, or to help relax you. There's a variety of things that you can, messaging that you can send, but the analogy here is that if you put a doctor in the loop, the doctor can view the physiology online, and the doctor can prescribe different messaging therapies. So, and it's exactly the same model as prescribing medicine, but instead of him prescribing medicine, he'll prescribe certain images or certain messages that he thinks will be, you know, appropriate or help you get better. And the way we've been designing the content is we rate the content, so you have different dosages. So you have like a mild dose, a stronger dose, etc. And it can also be highly personalized, because now you can bring in the full power of a social network or Facebook, etc. To help create this content. So we think of it as an adjunct to real-time, you know, doctor's therapy. The traditional model for global health has been telemedicine, where you have a health worker out in the field that will see the patient and can take some data. In this case, we developed a system at MIT through an organization named Sana, so you can look up sanamobile.org, and you can take pictures on your phone, fill out different questionnaires depending on, you know, what exactly the encounter is, you know, if it's like post-op visit or broken bone, etc. And then that data gets automatically sent to an open source medical record system called OpenMRS, which was originated from MIT and Harvard, and now, you know, sort of run out of Partners Healthcare on Huntington Avenue here. And then an expert, whatever the specific expertise you need, for example, it could be a radiologist to look at an X-ray, he would review the data and then send the recommendation and the feedback back to the health worker that's in the remote area. And this idea has been around for probably like 50 years now. And in fact, it originated out of some of the work through MGH and the remote clinic at Logan Airport. So we have multimedia, and now there's various, I'm just listing here a few different organizations that are building similar systems. That I mentioned Sana, but there's an Open Data Kit, or ODK, out of University of Washington. ComCare from another nonprofit company here named Dimagi. And then there's a various open source medical well, not all of these are open source, but here's some of the leading medical record databases that are available for global health. One thing I'll mention, since some people in this conference are interested in web services and sort of cloud computing, there's a lot of interest now in having a low-cost device on the front end that sends data up to the cloud, and then in the cloud you do some processing, and then you can send the data back. So it could be something like maybe you record your heart waveform for a few minutes, or it could be some other sort of vital signs or tests, and then you do all your processing in the cloud and send it back over something. It could be a text message or something more rich. We're looking at a variety of devices, sort of listening to heart-lung sounds. There's some examples of student projects, pulse oximeters, and people have even made ultrasound probes that can plug into a phone so you can see ultrasound. One side note here is that in certain regions of the world, such as India, sex selection is actually an issue, so people don't want to see an image of the baby, because if people see that it's a girl, sometimes the family will terminate the pregnancy, unfortunately. So companies have been creating new types of ultrasound that don't show an image and just simply measure some parameters and display numbers, like the baby is this big, and measure some other vital signs of the baby. There's a variety of other projects we're working on with collaborators to do blood pressure and even monitoring people in Uganda who have AIDS or HIV and are starting a drug treatment, and we're trying to be able to catch abnormal vital signs and then refer them to the hospital. There's another group at the Media Lab in particular that looks at innovative uses of cameras. And they've developed a variety of devices that you can snap onto the phone that do things like eye exam or scan your eye for cataract. And they have a spin-off company that's selling those devices. Another technology, and this is one that came out of Roz Picard's group, which was part of the group that I worked with, is using video to measure physiology. So it turns out that today's modern cameras, even a cheap $30 webcam, has enough dynamic range to measure very small color variations in your face, in your skin. And if you amplify that and filter it properly and do some processing, you can actually measure heart rate, because you can see the color in your face flashing. And if you can also do some segmentation, so you can look at the individual heart rate of everybody whose face is in the picture. So you can imagine having a conference call, and you could be actually monitoring people's heart rate. And so if you're having like an online poker game, this would be a very big advantage. So obviously, there's a lot of there's controversy as well regarding privacy and so forth. But this is, this is some of the things that we have to come to terms with new technology. And there's also, I have it on my computer, but not in part of this presentation. There's a really nice paper from SIGGRAPH this year illustrating this, and the video is actually online. So you can see somebody's face flashing. A project that I'm working on is using the mobile phone camera to look at the blood vein pattern, and this actually uses a special infrared light that you shine behind the hand. So you can use that as a biometric. You can also potentially do other physiology that way. There's people looking at, also at MIT, other collaborators creating innovative code. So you can imagine having like a QR code where the pixels and the QR code change depending on the results of the test. So this happens to be a test that you pee on, and when you this particular project was the challenge here was to provide someone with an incentive to take their medication. So you may be familiar with tuberculosis, and TB has one problem, which is that if you don't complete your medication, even though you may feel fine, the tuberculosis inside your body will start to mutate, and you might develop like a virulent strain of TB, which then becomes more difficult to fight. And that's becoming one of the health problems around the world, is that you have these mutant strains of things that are difficult. So this particular project is, we put a little additional ingredient into the tuberculosis pill. So when you take it, we give people these pee strips, and if you pee on the strip, it reveals a code. And if you punch in that code, you get extra cell phone minutes. So it's sort of an incentive to get people to take their medication. And since then, these have become more complicated. So we now have countermeasures against, for example, like people peeing on all the strips at once, or getting a friend to pee on it, et cetera. So there's always ways to beat the system, but you know, it's an arms race. And then there's another company here in the local area on Memorial Drive that came out of Harvard, Professor Whiteside's group, called Diagnostics for All, or DFA, and they've been developing a wide variety of very interesting diagnostic tests that are just printed on paper. So you can have a little postage stamp size test that runs like 20, and you put a drop of blood and it does like 20 tests, including, you know, like your liver functions, et cetera. So that's all happening, and the readouts is with a mobile phone. And then there's several groups around the world looking at using a phone as a microscope. One of the top ones is in UCLA, Professor Ozcan, some of his presentations are probably online, but they've done wonderful things using phones as microscopes. So I think, you know, there's many other examples, but I'll end there. There's many conclusions of this talk, but the main point is that there's many different ways to think about technology and different ways to think about what is really high tech. And spending time working in developing countries has sort of given me a different perspective of what technology is better than others. So what I've tried to do in this presentation is sort of present some slightly different perspective of and sort of question the way that we define high tech and think about ways that we can make it better and more sustainable. So I think I'll end there, and thank you. Oh, sure. The sensors that we use are skin conductance, which is basically what's used in lie detectors. And it turns out that instead of measuring on your fingertips, you can actually measure it in your ankle or on your wrist. And you get a lot of very interesting information. But we're also adding heart rate and other things. But I didn't mention it here, but one of the big revolutions that's happened in the past, you know, 10 or 20 years has been algorithms, machine learning, pattern recognition, all that. That's really been, and it's still just now, we're just starting on that's completely revolutionizing medicine and a lot of these other domains where you have large amounts of data and you need to make some decisions. Yeah. The cocaine addiction one in particular, there's a short paper on it in IEEE, and there'll be a bigger paper coming out in about 6 months, a longer paper on it. But there are a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, but there's several groups now that are starting to do this work, where combining wearable sensors with phones and a server and algorithms. Right.
The thing they're not very good at is knowing how they're reacting to a situation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes often the challenge to deal with. These sensors tell them, hey, it looks like you're unhappy about whatever, something is bothering you. Mm-hmm. So that you have this sort of external way of catching on psychological cues that people not on the spectrum can automatically get.
And yeah. Ross Picard has done a lot of work in autism technology, along with Matthew Goodwin, who now became new faculty at Northeastern here. But so the people who are low-functioning autistic people have trouble speaking, even, and they cannot always express how they're feeling. But you know, sometimes. When they're feeling very stressed, they'll just have a meltdown. So they'll start, you know, screaming or going on the floor. And so before they have a meltdown, we can see, you know, as Brian was saying, we can see their arousal going up, and you can intervene or change the activity. So it's been a very useful tool for families who have autistic children. So I never thought that I'd be working in a psychiatry department, because that seems like the complete, like, diametric opposite from, like, engineering and physics and material. But when you think about it, you know, like, what can you do with a phone? And it turns out that, you know, like, a phone is great at delivering, you know, videos and pictures, and also the phone is a gateway to social, you know, like, peer-to-peer influences. So when you think of it that way, you know, what things can a phone really help? And in most cases, it's things involving how you think, things involving your mind and psychiatry. So that's why a lot of these mobile applications are happening first in the psychiatry domain. And a lot of families are eager to find alternatives to medication. So using the mobile phone therapy as a first step before you go to meds is actually attractive. Yeah. On the research side, we've always wanted to build peer-to-peer phones, but because of the business model, you know, cell phone companies just have been against peer-to-peer. But now that we have these powerful social networks, I mean, people are now realizing the value of peer-to-peer and ways to make money off of it. So I think there's so many radios now available on phones that now with 4G that everything's IP, I think you know, people are running Skype on their phones and not even using the voice channel. They're just using pure data. That's all changing, yeah. And regarding, you know, 2G versus 3 and 4, continuing argument about how quickly will smartphones really spread to these remote areas? Because, I mean, obviously there's smartphones all over the, you know, and large countries like India, obviously in the cities, you know, the wealthy people all have smartphones and it's great. But if you go to the villages, almost everybody has a phone, but it's not a smartphone. and maybe 10% might be a Java programmable phone, you know, like a $50 phone. But it's coming. Like Kenya, as I mentioned, Kenya is one of the people that have been on the leading edge. And Huawei, one of the cell phone manufacturers, has made a really low-cost Android phone that's been enormously popular in Kenya. And obviously, it's subsidized, but it sells for like $80 or something. And so, oh, you have one? Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't give up on SMS. Like, I think I'm still doing projects that use SMS. And obviously, if you want coverage, you always want to rely on 2G data and SMS as a basic. But then certain places, you'll be able to do, you know, 3G, 4G. But I'm not assuming that 3G, 4G is going to be everywhere. Not for another, like, 5 years, probably. But that's just my opinion. Sure.
You showed that most of your recent work on that the common name for the when you say that we also are trying to do some similar stuff with BNN. Ah. I wonder that you already have that prototype available.
We have a way to acquire the image, but the ongoing work is the signal processing to do that. Yeah. And I should mention that the using veins for biometric is not completely new. That I think Toshiba and Fujitsu make a product one uses a finger and one uses the hand but it's mostly used in Japan for like banks and other security things. Yeah, that's biometrics in general are a little bit controversial. But one thing I'll mention, here's another example where developing countries are pioneering. So in India, the government last year came up with this crazy idea to do biometrics on everybody in the whole country. So like have 1 billion biometrics, and they do like the fingerprint, the iris, and the idea was that because there's a lot of people who are illiterate and can't really sign or have they've been locked out of the system or taken advantage of when it comes to like banking or making certain deals. So the country has started. So it's called the Aadhaar project or UID project. They've made quite a bit of progress. But obviously, you know, when you have a billion, like you look at the error rate of biometrics, I mean, you're going to have like, you know, 0.0001%. There's going to be errors, but that 0.001% can be you know thousands of people. So I don't know how, you know, you're going to have you're going to need some backup forms of ID. But you know, these are growing pains. But I'm impressed that a country as big as India took on this challenge, and you know, yeah. What country? Chile. Okay, yeah. I agree with you. I think in most countries or most applications, they use the fingerprint as a kind of a secondary verification. But India is trying to use it as the primary. So like you only use the biometric. Like there's nothing else, and that's a little bit controversial. But also your question is correct that we don't know like how your veins change as you're growing. So if I do biometric on like a 6-month-old baby, you know, how does that compare with like 2 years later, you know, on the same hand? So, yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if they're doing this iterative updating, but I think it's good. And one of the reasons that they move away from fingerprints is because a lot of farmers or laborers might have calluses or their fingerprints rub off. But yeah, certainly the iris and the blood vessels seem to be a pretty good direction.